أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، حبيب إله العالمين، أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. I struggled similarly, as David mentioned some of his struggles. I was born into a Ismaili Bora community, and we lived in South Carolina in the deep south as immigrants. And the community that I lived in, it was dominated by Salafi Wahhabis. Ours was the only practicing Shia family who was involved in the community. We had a lot of influence from my father, who would let us kind of read polemical works to us in Urdu and in English, and teach us about Sunnis and Shias and the history and things like that. So we had a basis for that, but we knew we weren't Boras. We knew we weren't Sunnis. We didn't know much about Shias except the Imama in general, and just Imam Ali. So he was really our only link to Tashayyu was Imam Ali himself. And of course, Imam Hussein during Majalis, but not really as a constant influence in our lives. But I remember even after in college, I finally became a committed Shi'i to some extent, and not yet really knowing the law and not yet knowing all the different beliefs, I still struggled with many things, especially a lot of the practices that we have around Ashura. Even the Torba, I remember even after when I first got into the Hawza in Chicago, I still wouldn't pray on the Torba. When I learned that it was wajib to pray on something, either the earth or something from the earth, but neither eaten nor worn. So I wanted to do the bare minimum. I still was uncomfortable with the torba, so I'd take a piece of wood or a piece of paper, and I would always do sajda on that, but never on the torba itself. Because I always had the voices of the Wahhabis in the back of my head, saying this is shirk and you're worshipping this idol and these kinds of things. And even the commemorations, I think it's valuable. Sometimes in the first couple of days, I try to read. There are a lot of hadith that we have from the Ahlul Bayt to help us understand how they used to commemorate, and the poetry that we recite now. I don't know. I see faces that may be unfamiliar with our community, or maybe you are familiar. You've been here for a while, and I just haven't seen you. But so the poetry that we're trying to create now, and you know, sometimes it's beautiful. Sometimes we struggle with it, but it's part of a long tradition. And so we have lots of ahadith where the imams are patronizing different poets in their times to get them to give an emotional to bring out the emotions and to express emotions and to tell the story, recount the story of Karbala. And they would reward them with monetary gifts. They would give them bags of gold and silver to reward them for their efforts. And so it's part of a long tradition. When I saw those ahadith, and it helped me to connect with the tradition more, and to realize this is not something that we've invented, not something that we've artificially created, but it's actually something that Ahlul Bayt themselves have started, and they want us to do it. Right? The form can change; it doesn't have to be a particular language, doesn't have to be a particular meter, particular form. You don't have to have one style of poetry before and a different style of poetry after the majlis. Like all those things that we've come up with, those are fine. Those are different formulas and different ways we've come up to do, you know, with to do it. It doesn't have to be like that. As long as it's done in a way that's effective, that keeps the message alive, keeps feelings and emotions alive, these feelings of attachment towards Imam Hussein, right, all that, if that's being served, then the media are many. Recite one salawat. So we spoke the last 3 days about poverty as a challenge for humanity, and specifically as a challenge for poor people themselves. I want to switch gears now and speak about the challenge that it presents to those who are well off. And I've struggled to try to find a word for the opposite of poor, which isn't just rich. I don't know if you have a suggestion. I know we have middle class and those kinds of words, but something a little bit less economical and more, I don't know, real and poetical or something like that. But even in... Yeah, well-off also has, I think it has a connotation. What else? That's rich, though. Comfortable and be good. Yeah. What else? Yeah. So something maybe comfortable is good. Even in Arabic we have, huh?
Content or blessed?
Well, content should be always, inshallah. Whether you're poor or rich, you're content. That's the goal always, regardless of your superficial circumstances. So that's a spiritual, that's a ethical and spiritual state, not a definition of how much you have and how much you need. Yeah, so even in Arabic, we have faqir and ghani, poor and rich. And ghani simply, it means anything that's not poor. Right, so it doesn't necessarily mean filthy rich. It can be anything in between. After poverty, once you have enough that you can suffice your needs and the needs of your dependents, then you're ghani. Your needs are sufficed, something like that. So we'll have to come up with some term. I haven't been able to think of something yet. So maybe comfortable works the best. So those who are comfortable, poverty poses a challenge for us too. And that, for the first night I mentioned, this is the reason I phrased the topic as I did, as a challenge for humanity, not simply for the people who are experiencing it firsthand. It presents a challenge to the rest of us, not in that very guttural and tangible way that we're actually feeling the pangs of hunger and feeling the pinch of the pocketbook necessarily, but it does present those same spiritual challenges, the same challenges that we discussed with the poor person trying to make sense of why and how it can be that I can be poor when Allah is all-powerful and all-wise and has everything in His hands and has promised to provide for everyone. How can I still be poor? So for us all, for us, inshallah, if we are in that comfortable category, then it's also a challenge to make sense of those same things. One thing I thought it would be interesting to see is let's explore the question about whether poverty is actually an integral part of life, or if it is something that can be separated from life, and maybe it is an ideal, there is a utopia in which poverty will no longer exist. Recite one salawat, and if everyone can move forward, it's crowding near the door. Move forward, please. Please, sisters especially, there's a lot of room up in front, and you're crowded around in the back. Could I get some water as well? Someone? All right, so one way I thought we could look at this is the utopia that we are, inshallah, expecting and hoping for any day now is the utopia of the government of Imam Mahdi, alayhi salam. Recite with salawat. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So for those of you who are unfamiliar, this is a common belief amongst all the Muslims that there is a personality called the Mahdi, the guided one, who will come back at some time. He's a descendant of the Prophet. He is one who will finally fulfill the desire of all the prophets of God and of God himself to finally establish the rule of God on earth, though it was always intended to be, but we've never been successful. Never, except for minor experiments here and there. Glamorous experiments, sometimes the Kingdom of Solomon, for instance. Right? So sometimes we had governments like that, they're ruled by a prophet of God that were samples of what it could be. But inshallah, one day when he's able to rule, it'll be finally that utopia of a purely Islamic system ruled on the principles of Islam, where the entire globe will be ruled by this one just ruler, and he'll fill the earth with justice, just like it was filled with injustice. يَمْلَأُ الْأَرْضَ قِسْطًا وَعَدْلًا كَمَا مُلِئَتْ جَوْرًا وَظُلْمًا وَجَوْرًا. That's a common belief amongst all the Muslims. As Shia, as 12er Shia in particular, we know that this Mahdi is the 12th Imam, who's already been born. And because of circumstances, and because really the circumstances aren't ready, because we have never been ready. He hasn't been able to do what he needs to do, and he's been lifted off and kind of in this occultation and put out of harm's way for the time being until we get our act together. And when we can get our act together, not only as his followers, but all people in general, when there's a general perception, when there's a majority of human beings who realize that human endeavor can't solve our problems, that we need divine help, we need him to step in, put his guy on earth and make things work, show us how to do things, show us how to implement systems properly, what to stand by, what to fight against, and set everything straight. And when that happens, then inshallah this government will be in place. So in that government, that will be a utopia? Will poverty be eradicated, or will it still be there? So for that repeated phrase, يَمْلَأُ الْأَرْضَ قِسْطًا وَعَدْلًا كَمَا مُلِئَتْ ظُلْمًا وَجَوْرًا, we understand that injustice will be eradicated. That too, sometimes we have a very fairy tale-like image of how that's going to happen, that somehow magically he's going to wave his hand and everything's going to be set aright. And that's not the way. That's never been the way of the prophets or the imams to fix things or fix people miraculously. The miracles had their place. The miracles the prophets would produce, they were there to convince people who couldn't be convinced just by ideas. The Salmans and the Abu Dhars and these kinds of people who were searching for truth and had traveled great distances and endured much hardship just to seek the truth, they didn't need anything more than for the Prophet to open his mouth and say, I am the Prophet of God and here's what I stand for. And they said the Shahada on the spot. They believed in him. But there are those who needed those miracles, who needed to see supernatural things that could only be done by God himself or someone empowered by God. And these miracles serve that purpose of presenting them with proof that, yes, I am from God. When they still had the option, it was still their choice whether to accept that and say, yes, I believe now, or like Pharaoh, وَجَحَدُوا بِهَا وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنفُسُهُمْ ظُلْمًا وَجَوْرًا. The Quran tells us that despite the fact that he had complete yaqeen, complete certainty that what Moses was doing was something that no human being could possibly do, and this is only by the power of God, he still refused to believe. So we have that choice. Even at that point, when a miracle is presented, it's not to force us to believe, it's to make it undeniable that this is truth. But we still can deny it, unfortunately, because we are human beings and we have that will. So we have a hadith that tells us that when he makes his stand, it won't be a quick process. It won't be an easy process. Right? There's one phrase I remember where he says that it will be... They'll have to ride hard and they'll have to endure all sorts of difficulties in food and drink and whatever else it'll be a hard journey, a hard battle, everything will be hard for some time until finally things can be established. Because again, he's not coming in to destroy everyone who's opposed to him. His goal is to guide everyone. And Imam Hussein didn't specifically go to fight. He specifically went to guide. Right, the fight comes when there's resistance and there's blindness and people adamantly standing against truth and refusing to believe truth, refusing to listen to truth. That's when fight comes. And the same will happen with Imam Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala farajah. That he will first be there to guide people, to guide all people this time. Those who stand in his way adamantly, who are masters of unjust systems and refuse to cease, right, they will be on the other side of the battlefield. But those who have questions, those who have doubts, those who are seeking truth, there's no battle for them. There's talking and answering questions and clarifying and perhaps even showing miracles. We have lots of hadith that tell us that he'll have the power to produce miracles as well for those who need it. He'll have some of the relics of the prophets of old, the staff of Moses, the stone that Moses would strike and the 12 streams would come out. So different ahadith tell us and prophesy that he'll have these different means at his disposal to convince those who need convincing. So it will be a struggle, it will be hard, but eventually a time will come when things are successful, when all people believe. All people believe in the Shahadatain. So in that time, after everything's settled, and we finally have that utopian government ruled by Imam Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala faraja, will there still be poverty or not? There's one hadith that I found. There are many hadith that talk about the fact that there will be no oppression, there will be no injustice, there'll be, wealth will be distributed fairly, all these sorts of things. This one phrase comes, it's from Kitab al-Irshad by Shaykh al-Mufid. I won't read the entire hadith, but he talks about different things that will happen in that time. إِذَا قَامَ الْقَائِمُ حَكَمَ بِالْعَدْلِ وَارْتَفَعَ فِي أَيَّامِهِ الْجَوْرِ. So he will rule justly, all injustice will be done away with. وَأَمِنَتْ بِهِ السُّبُلُ. All roads, all roads will be safe. وَأَخْرَجَتِ الْأَرْضُ بَرَكَاتِهَا. He'll fully exploit and take advantage of all the blessings that are there under the earth, on the earth, and use them in the best way for the betterment of society. وَرَدَّ كُلَّ حَقٍ إِلَىٰ أَهْلِهِ. Every right will be given to the owner of that right. وَلَمْ يَبْقَ أَهْلُ دِينٍ حَتَّى يُظْهِرُ الْإِسْلَامِ. Not a single believer will remain except for Muslims. Homeland Security, I remember a few years ago, I was stopped. The one time I was stopped, and it gave me a big hassle when I first come back from Iran. About 4 hours they stopped me, and the guy had probably read a book on Imam Mahdi and something like that, so he had all these ideas in his head that he could throw out at me and try to trap me. And this is one of the things he threw out at me. Don't you believe in the Mahdi? Which he wasn't supposed to. We filed a lawsuit against him in Michigan, and CARE is still fighting that for us there. But he asked us about our religious beliefs. Do we believe in the Mahdi? And I, not knowing, I said yes. And he said, don't you believe he's gonna wipe out everyone who's not a Muslim? He's gonna kill everyone, right? And I stopped there. I didn't answer anymore. That's sometimes how people twist this. When it says that no one will be left except Muslims, right? Don't think of Muslim as an equivalent for brown, for instance. Sometimes we have that in our mind that if you're brown, you're Muslim. Right? If you're not brown, then you're not quite a Muslim, or you're not a Muslim. And sometimes we have those equations in our head where we think of religion as a kind of race or a kind of thing that you're born with. And those who are not born Muslim are not quite Muslim. Right? Oftentimes in our community, you'll have people say, so-and-so married a Christian. And then you realize that person who they're calling a Christian actually converted 20 years ago. She's been a Muslim for 20 years, and they're still calling her a Christian because she's not brown. So religion is not something you're born with. Sometimes we are born with it, but it's not something necessarily you're born with. It's something that you believe in, that you choose to believe in, or you choose to give up, right? And so it's not that he's going to come and say, whoever is Muslim right now is saved, and whoever's not Muslim right now, we're going to fight him. Right? Like I said, the whole point is to guide people, and to guide as many people as possible. Whoever's willing, whoever has any motivation to know the truth and believe in the truth, they're going to be guided. Either they'll believe willingly or they'll be convinced. They'll have their questions, they'll have their doubts, they'll express their reasons for why they're not quite sure, and he'll give them answers that will satisfy anyone who wants to know the truth. And then there are always those miracles that are there to remove any shadow of a doubt that this person is in fact empowered by God himself. So the only person who can stand up to any of that is someone who is completely dead to the truth. Right? Then he goes on and says, أَمَا سَمِعْتَ اللَّهَ سُبْحَانَهُ يَقُولُ وَلَهُ أَسْلَمَ مَنْ فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ طَوْعًا وَكَرْهًا وَإِلَيْهِ يُرْجَعُونَ. And he goes, وَحَكَمَ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ بِحُكْمِ دَاوُودِ. One of the characteristics of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will be that he will rule the way David used to rule, which it's an allusion to the particular sanction that Prophet David, peace be upon him, had, where he was allowed to rule not based on evidence and testimony and these kinds of things, but he was allowed to rule based on his own knowledge of the truth. So through ilm al-ghayb, the knowledge that Allah himself gave him to know exactly who's guilty and who's innocent, he was able to use that to rule. According to ahadith, it was only given to him because he wanted it, Allah gave it to him, and as soon as he did it a couple of times, he ruled like that. The consequences of ruling like that were so heinous for him, the backlash from his people was so terrible that he went back. And he said, I can't rule like this because my people will rebel. Right? When someone comes in and says, you're guilty, and the evidence points to your innocence, right? People are not going to have confidence in your ruling. Even though it's right, he was judging not based on his own personal knowledge, but based on Allah's knowledge that this person is guilty. But if there's no evidence pointing to the guilt of that person, then that eats away at people's trust and their faith, and very quickly they started to revolt against him. So he went back on that as well. But Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, one of the characteristics that's mentioned over and over again in the hadith is that he'll be able to rule like this. Possibly one of the reasons is this, that the Prophet, our old Prophet, of course he had the ability, the Imams had the ability to rule like this, to judge like this as well. They'd all have access, if Allah wanted them to have access to knowledge of the unseen. There's no need for them to call a witness, right? Or present for someone to present evidence to them, for them to judge. They could have knowledge directly from Allah. But they were trying to also teach us and make sure that we knew how to carry on a court of law after them. And so by creating the whole system of testimony and witnesses and all these different things, they were able to demonstrate for us how to judge cases with our own limited knowledge, where we don't have access to anything beyond the apparent evidence. But in Imam Mahdi's time, there's no more preparation for some later time. He is the end. He's the last ruler, the last of the divine guides. Once he's gone, then the world is gone. There's no more preparation for anything. Rather, he's the culmination and the end goal of all of creation.
فَحِينَ إِذَنْ تُظْهِرُ الْأَرْضُ كُنُوزَهَا وَتُبْدِي بَرَكَاتِهَا وَلَا يَجِدُ الرَّجُلُ مِنْكُمْ يَوْمَئِذٍ مَوْضِعًا لِصَدَقَتِهِ.
This is what I wanted to quote. He says, on that day, in those days when he rules, the earth will... He personifies the earth as presenting all of its treasures. So we'll be able to access, you know, all the resources that the earth has to offer, and those will all be extracted and will be used for the benefit of all people. But then he says, وَلَا يَجِدُ الرَّجُلُ مِنْكُمْ. On that day, no person will be able to find a place, a person to give his sadaqah to. And you won't be able to find, you have sadaqah to give, you have your zakah and your khums to give, because you have the savings, or you've earned enough. And when you go looking for someone, you're not able to find anyone worthy of sadaqah and zakah, meaning there's no poor person left to give sadaqah and zakah to. So one idea that our scholars have based on that is that poverty will be eliminated altogether. But when you look at different ahadith, that's not necessarily the case. And even this hadith, that's not the only way to interpret the hadith. There's one time when poverty is exterminated altogether, right? That itself, again, we said that the government and the way he works is going to be through natural systems. It's not miraculous at that point. He's not making things happen. He's not conjuring anything through miracles, right? He's using the resources that are there. He's governing. He's using the resources of people as his governors, as his rulers, you know, to manage this whole system in the best way possible, given the limitations of the world in which we live. And so it's not that poverty itself will be eradicated, but rather we know that dhulm and jawr, injustice, will be eradicated. And that, as we noted earlier in the discussions, that's one of the major factors at play that prevents people from getting what they're supposed to get. The systems of injustice that inshallah we'll try to talk a little bit more about in today and tomorrow's lecture. So those systems of injustice, that systematic injustice, will be eradicated. Now we'll have economic systems and political systems and, you know, penal systems and all the different systems that are at play that now cause so many problems for so many people and prevent the even distribution of wealth, the fair distribution of wealth, prevent people from getting what they've earned, prevent, you know, take things from people that are rightfully theirs, take lives from people when they shouldn't be taken. All those systems will be eradicated, again, through this painful and, real process that he'll have to undergo. So that will be removed. But that's not the only cause for poverty. Right? Poverty is also caused sometimes by our own circumstances, by our own, sometimes it's even our own inability to work through sickness, through handicap, through old age. Right? That also brings on poverty through becoming an orphan. Right? So those aspects of poverty, like sickness, like so many other hardships that are parts of life, will continue to be there during that time as well. It's not that poverty will be eradicated altogether. Poverty, like sickness, like death itself, death is not lifted during the time of Imam Mahdi. People live and die the same way they always live and die. They will become sick just like they always become sick. The difference, though, is that the system will be in place for those things to be taken care of in the best possible way. If there's sickness, that the help that can be offered will be offered to the person in the most efficient way, the most effective way, the most compassionate way, so that those who can be helped will be helped, and a system won't be in place which will prevent healthcare from reaching certain parts of the population and only be accessible to others. So poverty also will still be there. The ahadith that are saying that it will be, you won't find a place to give charity, the poor people will be there, but there's also even distribution of things. There's public collection of zakah, distribution of that zakah. So it's going to become very difficult, more and more difficult, because those who are poor, and there will be poverty, their poverty will be solved, at least temporarily, by the charity that's being given by people. That doesn't mean that that person is now self-sufficient and they'll never be poor again. It's just that their current need has been filled. And then a few weeks later, a few months later, when they need again, then again, people will rush to try to give them charity and fulfill their needs. And so there will be poverty, but that poverty will be constantly filled. The voids will be constantly filled and people's needs will be constantly taken care of. Right? So it's not that poverty will be eradicated altogether. So the point then is that poverty is not something, it's not simply an evil and a result of evil. It is also part and parcel of the way life works. Just like sickness and health come and go, sometimes you're healthy and sometimes you're sick, not because of some evil necessarily. Similarly, poverty also is sometimes determined for you because that's in your best interest. Sometimes wealth is determined for you because that's in your best interest. And sometimes as a test, sometimes as expiation for sin, for all these different reasons that are at play, those will continue even in the time of Imam Mahdi's government, ajallahu ta'ala faraja. Recite one salawat. One more, please. So that's one of the many challenges to our belief. The same challenges that we've talked about before, this is one other aspect of that. Now let's talk about practical challenges to those who are comfortable, those who are well off. Poverty now that does exist and is an inevitable part of life, it's now going to present challenges to those who are not experienced in poverty in so many different ways to test their humanity and their pathos and their courage and so many different aspects to see what they're going to do now as a reaction to the poverty that does exist that others are facing. So it tests their pathos, their ability to empathize with others, to feel their pain, even when they themselves are not feeling the same pain directly, but to be able to feel the pain vicariously through the pain of others. There's one phrase from Imam Ali's letter 31 in Nahjul Balagha, which he writes to Imam Hassan alayhi salam, where he expands on the golden rule. He says, "My son, make yourself a standard for your relations with others. Love for others what you love for yourself, and detest for them what you detest for yourself. Do not wrong others just as you would not like to be wronged, and do good to them just as you would like good to be done to you. Consider deplorable from yourself what you consider deplorable from others, and accept from people what you accept from yourself for them. Do not say what you do not know, even if what you know be little. And do not say what you do not wish to be said to you. Know that self-conceit is the enemy of good conduct and an indication of an affliction to the intellect." So it's an expansion on the golden rule, right? So if we were in that position, if we were in that person's shoes, how would we like to be treated? What help would we like to receive? What compassion would we like to be shown? What respect would we like to be shown? And so all those things that we would like for ourselves, if we were in that position, we should also make sure that we treat that person the same way. And so it creates this test atmosphere for us to see whether we have the empathy to treat people as we would like to be treated if we were in their position, and who knows when we will be in their position. Because wealth is not in our power to have, and poverty can come at any time, not because of something that we do, but because Allah's decisions for us sometimes change for factors that are beyond our control completely. That taqdeer that we talked about yesterday, that comes not only as consequences of what we've done, but many times just out of the wisdom of Allah, He decides that now the best thing for this person is to taste some poverty, to taste some hardship. And so He makes things change in our life in ways that are completely beyond our control, and He presents a new test for us to see how we'll deal with that new test. And so the tides can turn very quickly, and wealth can turn to poverty just as poverty can turn to wealth.
It also creates a test for us in terms of our belief in where our sustenance comes from. I hinted at this before as well. If you look at the phrases in the Quran that talk about infaq, Allah will say, for instance, الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ, or for instance, وَمِمَّا رَزَقْنَاهُمْ يُنْفِقُونَ. Right, that phrase comes a lot. مِمَّا رَزَقْنَا يُنْفِقُونَ. That he praises people, he praises believers who spend. He always, almost always uses the phrase مِمَّا رَزَقْنَا, that they spend out of what we have provided for them. There's one place that I remember where he talks about what you've earned, right? أَنْفِقُوا مِنْ طَيِّبَاتِ مَا كَسَبْتُمْ, something like that. I may have mistaken some of the words. But spend out of the good things that you have earned yourself. Then he immediately backs up with وَمِمَّا أَخْرَجْنَا مِنَ الْأَرْضِ أَخْرَجَ لَكُم مِنَ الْأَرْضِ, that we've brought out for you from the earth and given to you as gifts. But my point is that the conception that we should have is not that I work and therefore I earn my paycheck, or that I toil, and because I toil, that's the cause for my sustenance. Rather, the causal relationship is only between Allah as the provider and the provision that He provides. Right, that was part of the point of laying out that whole system in one of the earlier lectures, to say that our role when we do our work and when we do whatever our duties are is simply to flip the switches and kind of satisfy the preconditions for Allah's sustenance to come, for Him to provide for us. He is the provider. And I say, when we say, for instance, the father of or the husband is the provider of the household, it's a figurative usage. Allah is the provider of all households, right? That provision simply comes through the form of a person working and getting a paycheck and going to the grocery store or farming and harvesting and those kinds of things. Those are simply the means by which Allah sends sustenance to us. So when He asks us to spend, to do infaq, and to give charity, He also helps us to, by motivating us and also by removing the inherent kind of obstacle that we have. Our nafs immediately tells us that, but I worked really hard for that. And I'm the one who sacrificed my time and my effort, my energy to earn this. Do I really have to give it away now? And so He immediately says, أَنْفِقُوا مِمَّا رَزَقْنَاكُمْ, spend out of what we gave you in the first place anyway. It's not really yours to begin with. It was a gift that I gave you. Yes, you worked, you fulfilled the prerequisite for it, but it's still my gift to you. Right? So when I'm asking you to give it to somebody else, first of all, I'm not saying to give everything. You take what you need, use what you need. Right? That's for you. But what you can spare, right, spare that and realize it wasn't yours to store and hoard anyway. You're simply a conduit for me to get to the other people. Their sustenance, those poor people's sustenance, is coming, just like yours came through a paycheck, theirs comes through your charity. And so you're simply a conduit for my sustenance, which I provided for you, to now move on and go to someone else, once you've taken your share and you've used it as you need to and done whatever you want to do with it. So that's also a huge test. It tests our ability to give that charity. It also tests our perception of how sustenance works, to make sure that we remember and realize that it's not ours to have to begin with. So Qarun is great example, negative example for the epitome of greed, and someone who's completely lost track of that system. He had been a righteous servant. He had been, he's one of the Bani Israel. He's a follower of Moses. And because of his righteousness and his goodness, Allah gives him all these gifts, the wealth. The way the Quran describes, oftentimes the Quran will use very poetical ways of describing things. So instead of telling us how much wealth he had, it simply tells us that the key to open the treasuries of his wealth was such a large key that it would take multiple men
to carry the key, lift the key to be able to open the lock to his treasuries. So it doesn't tell us what's inside the treasury, it just simply tells us how big the key is. Right? The Quran does that sometimes. Sometimes, for instance, it'll describe the clothing of people in paradise. It won't tell us what the clothing's made of, but it'll tell us what the lining of the clothing is. Right? Usually the lining of your clothing is not really nice fabric. It's the outside, that's the fine wool or the fine silk or whatever it is. Right? The inside is just probably cheap fabric, just whatever's gonna work. Right? But it'll tell us, for instance, the lining of their clothing or the lining of their pillows and the furniture is made out of like fine silk. So if the lining is a fine silk, then you can only imagine what the outside must be like. So they use poetic devices like that sometimes to describe things in a way that's a little bit more interesting than just telling us straight up. And so it tells us that about his wealth, but his folly was that he says, إِنَّمَا أُوتِيتُهُ عَلَىٰ عِلْمٍ عِنْدِي. That all this wealth that I've gotten, right? In our terms, we'd say, for instance, I earned this with my own two hands. It's all my hard work that with which I've amassed all this wealth. Right? So I don't have, that poor person, he should work harder. If he worked as hard as I did, then he could have as much as I. He's the Donald Trump of the day, right? And so he's warned, Moses warns him, other people around him warn him, and he doesn't heed any of it. And so eventually, فَخَسَفْنَا بِهِ وَبِدَارِهِ الْأَرْضِ. Yeah, we made not only him, all of his wealth as well, made the earth to swallow it up. And so he's completely consumed by the earth and destroyed immediately. So Qarun is a great example for the worst attitude that you can have towards the sustenance, to forget that it's from Allah and to think that it's from yourself. It also, poverty also tests those who are comfortable and well off. It tests our courage to see whether we have not only courage, intelligence, resourcefulness, all those different characteristics to effect change against the systems that are at play. So we talked a little bit about systems in general. They're unjust systems that are there to block Allah's sustenance, which is guaranteed for those who fulfill his prerequisites. Allah's fulfilled his end of the bargain. People have sometimes fulfilled their end of the bargain, but there's still those things that are coming in the way that are preventing Allah's sustenance from reaching. Not because they've overpowered Allah, Allah's all-powerful, but because he himself has decided to make a system that allows for people to come and block his sustenance from reaching. That's part of the system, that's part of the way he's created it. If he wanted, he could remove those things and miraculously make everything that he desires for someone to come to every person, and there would be absolutely no poverty. Of course he has the power to eradicate poverty himself, but that's not part of the plan right now. The plan is to have these tensions, these temptations, all these different things. He's created a world that creates these tests for all people involved. The haves, the haves, not have-nots, the ones who commit the oppression, the people who are oppressed, and the bystanders. Everyone's tested in his own way, and that's really the whole purpose of the world, to present those tests to us, to see how we fare in all the different tests that we have in life. And depending on how we fare, then that's what kind of person we become. And based on that, our judgment will also be passed on us. So the unjust systems, there are more than I can mention. I want to just touch on a few. There are things that you've all heard of, I'm sure you've all thought about. And I hope you have more expertise and more knowledge to understand how we can address these things, and how you particularly in your life can address some of these systems and topple some of these systems and change some of these systems to make the world at least a little bit more just by your action. But it's still worth going through and talking about them to some extent. So one of these things that the Quran really comes down hard on, and our the Sharia comes down hard on, is interest and interest-based economies. And this is the heart and soul of our economy worldwide right now, and I don't know how long it's been like that. So the Quran, for instance, in Surah Al-Baqarah says that أَحَلَّ الْبَيْعَ وَحَرَّمَ الْرِبَى. Like, proper transactions, buying and selling of commodities is halal, and riba is haram. Riba, usury, interest, that's one aspect of riba. Actually, there are two kinds of riba. We usually only think of one. So in our fiqh, one kind of riba that we don't really have too much of probably now, maybe in buying and selling gold and those kinds of things, we do experience it. But if you have a commodity that's either weighed or it's so either has it's sold by weight or sold by volume, you're not allowed to exchange that commodity in a like a bartering system for any increase. So the textbook examples, which are probably not relevant to us now, would be like, for instance, one person has like a pound of rice, and you have a pound of rice, and so I give you my pound of rice, which may not be of good quality, and I buy a pound and you know a few ounces of your rice. So I take more of your rice for less of my rice, but they're both rice. That's called riba as well. That's haram. If you're going to exchange commodity for commodity, it has to be equal weight or equal volume, however that commodity is weighed or sold. Probably in gold and silver, maybe that happens. Like say, you know, somebody has you have some old gold jewelry that you want to exchange for some new jewelry. And so you take jewelry into the dweller, and it might weigh, you know, I don't know, 2 ounces. I don't know, that's maybe probably too much. Like 2 ounces, for instance. And so you give that 2 ounce piece of jewelry of gold, and then he's not going to give you a 2 ounce piece of jewelry back. He's going to give you a 1.8 ounce thing. He's going to take his cut. So you're giving him a particular weight of gold, and he's giving you less. Right, that would also be riba. Right, so that transaction has to be fixed. You have to use money to buy it, or use some other kind of workaround to make that work. But you know, commodities can't be exchanged like that. The riba that we're more used to is loans, to lend money with the condition that when you repay the loan, you'll pay something extra. You'll pay that interest along with it. Right, that's also prohibited. Sometimes we think that there may not be that much harm in it, but you've all experienced this, or you've seen how credit card debt, how extravagant interest rates on student loans. Maybe you're feeling that right now, and if not now, then you will be for the next 20 years or so as you pay off your education here at NYU. So those systems that are in play that make you as a student who's trying to educate yourself pay extravagant rates of interest, but for instance, turn the other way and give free loans to banks and other very wealthy institutions, right? Those systems are unjust. It's creating a barrier for people to achieve education, and even if they do get their education, it puts such a burden of debt on them that either they will remain in poverty for a long time, it may cause poverty, and certainly it changes your life decisions. Many times people have to do things and take up jobs and live life in a certain way that's not ideal and doesn't live up to their ideals simply because they have to pay off this debt that's looming over them for so long. So interest-based loans, it's a way for people to take advantage of people who already needed the loan in the first place. You didn't have the money to spend yourself, you're borrowing it from me in the first place, you're already in a position of poverty, and now I lend it to you on condition that you're going to pay me back extra. So not only am I not helping, I'm helping you very temporarily, but really I'm not helping you at all, because now I'm going to take from you more and put you in more of a hole than you were in to begin with, all else being equal, assuming you haven't been able to somehow make a lot of money in the meantime, which is usually not the case. And so it simply promotes that poverty and compounds that poverty that's already there in that person who had to borrow in the first place, and makes it even harder for them to ever escape from that hole of poverty, and simply pushes them further and further down. So it is, in its very spirit, at its very core, a system of injustice. What is the solution? I don't know. I don't think we have any solution except to actually change the world in this particular way. So that's out of my league, and maybe that's something that you all could work on. Those of you who have expertise in those areas that can make things, think of a new system, think of a way to implement that system and how to do all that. That's something that's larger than me. But some institutions that we do have within the Islamic system that, at least on a smaller scale, will alleviate some of the problem for some of the people. We have this institution of Qard Hasan. Right, when you see someone who is in need, instead of giving them a loan that, on which we're going to take interest, what we're supposed to be doing is, if we can, give them an interest-free loan that will get them out of the hole and they can pay back in equal kind. Right? The same amount that's given to them, they give that same amount back. It seems like a complete loss then. If your whole idea about making money is that I have capital and I make money off of the capital I have, then of course it seems like a complete loss. The Quran addresses that. It says, وَمَا آتَيْتُمْ مِنْ رِبًا لِيَرْبُوَ فِي أَمْوَالِ النَّاسِ فَلَا يَرْبُوا عِنْدَ اللَّهِ. The money that you give, that you lend out, hoping to make money off of people through riba, you do increase your wealth in the world, in the dunya, but in Allah's eyes, you haven't increased anything. You've decreased. The barakah of that money, the punishment that you're incurring, the oppression that you're causing, all of that, in Allah's eyes, you've done so much worse for yourself. You've wasted the capital you had. You could have made, made it rich in Allah's eyes with that capital, but you invested it in usurious transactions, and actually you've lost completely in His eyes. وَمَا آتَيْتُم مِّن زَكَاةٍ تُرِيدُونَ وَجْهَ اللَّهِ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُضْعِفُونَ. But the zakah that you give, counterintuitively, if you give zakah, or in this case, if you give a qard hasan, it doesn't have to be pure charity where you give up the money. You can give it on condition that the person pay you back. That's a interest-free loan. Right? That's, in Allah's eyes, even though in our calculation, I'm giving you $10 and you're paying me back $10, I've broken even only. In Allah's eyes, I've invested that money very wisely. That $10 investment that I put in you and that you now gave me $10 back on, I have profited immensely from that. أُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُضْعِفُونَ. People who have these kinds of transactions, these are the winners who are doubling and redoubling their capital. His calculations are not like the same as our calculations. And we know this. We know this through our own experience. We've been talking about that one verse. He opens up doors. He provides you with sustenance in ways you don't realize. And there's so many things that are counterintuitive in the Sharia where Allah is trying to get us to do certain things. And like, for instance, if I want to be respected by you, the way to be respected in your eyes is not to be arrogant. As soon as I act arrogantly, then in your perception of me, you're going to try to put me down. Your automatic human reaction to my arrogance will be to look for faults in me, to think less of me. If I want your respect, then I should act humbly. By lowering myself and acting humbly, that's what makes my esteem go up in your eyes. That's counterintuitive. To get to the goal, everyone wants to be high and have that dignity, but to get there, you need to lower yourself, and by lowering yourself, people will raise you up in their esteem and in their respect of you. If you want wealth, right? We think if you want wealth, you work harder, you save up more, you spend less. But in Allah's eyes, that's not the way to get wealth. Right? The way to get wealth is to give charity, for instance. If you give charity, even though you're decreasing on your balance sheet, right, the returns that you get from that, both in the form of wealth and other forms, and in the form of happiness in this world, in the form of reward in the hereafter, in the form of barakah, and the blessing and the goodness that comes of whatever wealth you're left with after you give that charity, the profits are incredible and the increase is incredible. If you don't have enough money in your life, one of the ways to get more money is to go for Hajj, which is not a cheap endeavor. Right? This year is $7,500 to go for Hajj. The oppressive Saudis, they up the price every year. Right? They increase the price and they still allow our people to be trampled because for the interests of their princes and their royalty. Right? So that's in their own place, and they'll inshallah be punished for that. But it's not a cheap endeavor. It's always been expensive. It's always been hard to go for Hajj. It's always been a challenge monetarily. That's why istata'a and this, the The requirement that you have to fulfill, or the prerequisite you have to fulfill, is you have to have enough money not only to pay for the journey, but also to have enough when you come back to carry on with your life. You don't have to suffer when you come back either. So that's one of the ways to actually increase your wealth, is to go for Hajj, spend all this money, go on this trip, do all these things, and that's one of the ways to increase your wealth. Again, counterintuitively, it doesn't make any sense to us. Or if you're hard up and you don't know if you can get married because you don't know if you're making enough money to be able to support now a second mouth to feed, right? The hadith say, you know, get married. One of the ways to increase your wealth is not to delay marriage or not get married because you don't have enough money. Get married, and just by getting married, Allah will find what he'll create ways for you to increase your wealth and to make enough, and the barakah will come. And the same with children. If you don't want to have children because you're afraid maybe I won't be able to support them, I don't have enough money to put them through college, I'm barely paying off my own loans now, how can I support this another child who's going to have put such a burden on me financially? Right? Again, he says, no, don't think about that. I'll provide for him or her. Right? You have the child, and that will be a source of actually more wealth, more barakah in your life. Right, so the counterintuitive rulings that he's giving us and guidance that he's giving us, where if we make our own calculations, we'd go the exact opposite directions, he says, no, that's not the right direction. If you want these things, here's what you have to do. Here are the secrets. Right? And so these qurud hasana, these loans, interest-free loans, this is one of the ways. If you really want to make money and invest your money wisely, then this is the way to invest it. When you have it, give it to those who don't have it, and take it back from them as a loan. It doesn't have to simply be charity. Charity is in its own place, but as a loan, when you're going to get everything back, you're going to break even from a dunyawi perspective, but you're going to win in Allah's eyes. Isn't that much better than winning in a dunyawi perspective and losing in the biggest way in Allah's eyes? Alright, recite one salawat. Let me stop there, inshallah. We'll continue with that tomorrow. I want to share with you one story which involves several people from the camp of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Habib ibn Muzahir was a companion of the Prophet and of Ali ibn Abi Talib, of Imam al-Hassan and of Imam al-Hussein. When Ali moved his capital from Medina to Kufa, Habib settled in Kufa and fought with Ali in his three wars. He was a hafiz of the Qur'an, he had memorized the entire Qur'an, and was known to recite the entire Qur'an in a single night. He was one of the few chosen by Ali to learn the secrets of death and affliction, such that he knew how and when he and others would die and what afflictions they would be subjected to. Mitham Tamar was one of those, Hujr ibn Adi, and Habib ibn Muzahir. Several individuals that were such a caliber that Imam Ali had actually disclosed to them the circumstances of their death. So they would know, and they would wait and expect and long for that moment when they could finally end everything and finish their lives. When Muslim bin Aqil arrived in Kufa, Habib and Muslim ibn Awsaja accepted the Kufan's pledges of allegiance on his behalf. But when Ibn Ziyad seized control of Kufa, they went into hiding until they heard that Hussein had been detained at Karbala. It was then that they stole out of Kufa to join him. Habib was 75 years old on the day of Ashura. When he entered the battlefield, he chanted his line of Raja's poetry. Despite his old age, he is reported to have killed 62 Kufan soldiers. Then Badil ibn Suraym attacked him and struck him with his sword. Another soldier from Tamim stabbed him with a lance. At this, Habib fell to the ground. As he tried to rise, Husayn ibn Numair struck him on his head with a sword, at which he fell on his face. Then a Tamimi soldier came to him and severed his head. Habib's death was hard on Imam al-Hussein, and his grief was apparent in his face. He called out, "You've done well, Habib. You were an outstanding man. You used to finish the entire Qur'an in a single night." At seeing the Imam's grief, Zuhayr ibn Qayn,
approached him and said, "May my mother and father be your ransom, O son of God's messenger. What is this broken spirit I see on your face? Do you not think we are fighting for truth?" Imam al-Husayn replied, "Of course, by God, by the God of creation, I most assuredly know with certainty that you and I are with truth and guidance." Zuhair said, "Then let us not worry, for we are heading toward paradise and its blessings." At this, Zuhair stood in front of Imam al-Husayn and solemnly requested permission to fight. It was granted. He fought fiercely until he had killed 50 horsemen. In the heat of the battle, he realized that the time for prayer was approaching. He rushed back to Imam al-Husayn and said, "Master, I was afraid I would miss Dhuhr prayer. Please lead us in prayer." It's reported that Abu Thumama al-Sa'idi came to the Imam also and made the same request to pray one last prayer together. The Imam said, "You have remembered the prayer. May Allah raise you among the devotees of the prayer and with those who are always aware of Allah. Yes, it is the beginning of Dhuhr." Imam Hussein's small force prepared itself for Salatul Khawf, the prayer of fear. He posted Zuhair ibn Qayn and Sa'id ibn Abdullah al-Hanafi in front of the congregation to guard against a frontal attack. As they began to pray, the Kufan army shot a barrage of arrows upon them. Sa'id ibn Abdullah intercepted these arrows in his shield and in his body in his attempt to save Imam Hussein's life. As the congregation finished its prayers, Sa'id fell to the ground with 13 arrows in his body. His dying words were, "O Allah, damn these people as you damned Ad and Thamud, and convey my salam to your prophet, and tell him what pain I suffered, for my sole desire was to procure your reward by defending the progeny of the prophet." And he turned to Imam al-Husayn and asked, "Did I fulfill my duty, O son of God's messenger?" Imam al-Husayn replied, "Indeed, you will reach paradise before me." As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdillah wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifinaik alayka minni salamullahi abadan ma baqit wa baqiya al-laylu wa an-nahar ولا جعله الله آخر العهد مني لزيارتكم السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين." Allah, we ask you to shower your mercy and blessings on Muhammad and the family of Muhammad. Accept these acts of devotion and this remembrance of Imam Hussein. Help us, Allah, to live lives worthy of Imam Hussein and to die as he died. Help us to increase in our knowledge, increase in our faith, increase in our good actions. Give us the akhlaq, the behavior, the etiquette, the character of the Ahlul Bayt in this world, and raise us in their midst on the hereafter. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
Ya Hussein,
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 Ya Hussein.